From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a number, A17606. That's what was tattooed on a teenage boy's arm when he arrived at Auschwitz. Jack Feldman survived the death camp and a six-month march ordered by Nazis as the Germans were losing the war. I could tell you more about Jack's story, his survival, and his family, but it's best if you hear it from him or from his remarkable great-great-grandson, Elliot. Now, Elliot noticed the number on Jack's arm one day and began to ask him questions. What Elliot learned about his great-grandfather's story is featured in the documentary, The Number on Great-Grandpa's Arm. The film is not just about the Holocaust. It's about the bond that Jack and Elliot share. It's one of 29 films in the lineup at this year's Rochester Jewish Film Festival. We will preview the festival this hour, and we got a lot to talk about here. This is only about a 19-minute film, but it is so touching, and we're so glad that Jack and Elliot are both with us. So first of all, Jack Feldman, welcome. Hello. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us is Elliot Sainz. Elliot, welcome to you. Thanks for being here to share the story as well.
Thank you.
And we're going to say hello to Stacy Sainz, who is Jack's granddaughter, Elliot's mom. We'll talk to her more as we go throughout the hour. She's with us this hour. Bonnie Abrams is director of the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information at the Rochester Community Federation. Bonnie, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also hello to Andrea Miller, who is the festival director. Just remarkable stuff. This film's just 19 minutes long, but it's beautiful, isn't it?
It's a beautiful film, yes, and it's part of our shorts program on opening day, Sunday, July 8th, and we're just thrilled to have it part of the festival this year.
Where can people see the lineup for the festival?
Our website is rjff.org. It's got all the information there.
Bonnie, have you seen it?
Oh, yes. It's fabulous. It's a fabulous film. It's very touching, and I'm really thrilled that we were able to show it.
I'm going to ask Elliot and Jack to walk us through some things here. And again, later in the hour, we'll bring Stacy in to kind of go back over how a lot of this came together. But I'm going to start with Elliot, who was 10 in the film. How old are you now? Are you 10?
I'm now 12.
You're 12. 12 years old. When's the first time you recognized the number, or you realized there was a number on your great-grandpa's arm and started thinking about it?
Well, I noticed it when I was younger, maybe like 4 or 5, but when I really started to put together its meaning was like late 5 and early 6. Mm.
Do me a favor, bud. Just grab that mic and point it right down to you, because the mic is too tall for the moment. Yeah, that mic, there you go. Better. So, Elliot, it's obvious to me that you're very close with your family, with your great-grandpa. But I also want to know if it has been difficult for you to learn what he went through.
Well, obviously at first it's sad and you're a little surprised of how it could happen. But then it starts to kind of grow on you and you realize that even though it's sad, you got to do something about it. You got to make it so it never happens again.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to pour these big questions on you. You're 12. But watching this film, you are a very wise young guy. I mean, for 10 in the film, very wise. How much do you think about how, I don't know, my son's half your age, and all kids want to do really is find friends and play with anybody. Do you think about a world in which people would do these terrible things? Is it confusing to you why that would ever happen?
Well, at first, it was confusing, and it obviously is still confusing because this is just a very horrible thing. But some people, if they want to do something, they just want to put the blame on someone else. They don't want to have to be like blaming themselves or realize that it's their own problem, and they blame someone else, and that's how something like this could start. And you just gotta stop it.
Everything that's going on in my life that's bad is because of the other, the person who's different. It's exactly what Elliot's saying. Blame somebody else, find a scapegoat, find someone who's different, pour your divisions onto them.
Yeah.
That's a really wise message from a guy who's now 12. Jack, I don't usually do this, but I gotta ask you, how old are you now?
80. No. 92.
92 years old. And you're from Poland.
Right.
And tell me a little bit about your relationship with Elliot.
Relationship? Very good. I enjoy him. We spend time together. And we do a lot of things together.
The film tells the story of how you spend a lot of time in the summers together.
Right.
And you do a lot of the things that grandparents will do with grandchildren or great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
But it's different to have to explain the Holocaust, war, human suffering like this. Why do you think it was so... It looks to me from the film that the conversation was pretty easy, or at least natural. There was just a simple flow to it between you two. Why? Elliot wants to jump in first. Go ahead.
So we talk about it a lot. So just being filmed for it, we're usually filmed because my mom, she is always trying to get all the information. And so we've been filmed on it a lot. And so it's very natural for the two of us to be on film. And so what's the difference if the whole world's going to see it?
Yeah. If you watch this film, again, it's only 19 minutes, but it's just Elliot and Jack having a conversation, and Jack seems to be open to any question that Elliot wants to ask, and it doesn't come off as contrived. It doesn't come off as scripted or planned. My guess is it wasn't, right? Jack, are you comfortable with your grandchildren asking anything they want?
Anything they want.
Do you worry about the emotional impact on them to understand?
No, Mom.
Elliot, was any part of it difficult for you?
Well, at first it was, but as I said before, it kind of grows on you and you kind of get used to it.
So, Jack, I can't ask you to tell us your whole life story, but why don't you, for our audience, take your time and tell us what you experienced. I mean, unfortunately, you experienced a great deal during the Holocaust and leading up to then. Can you give us the story?
Well, I went to school. I didn't finish school because the Germans came in. They took me to the camp.
That can't be the whole story. And Stacy, if you want, we can swing that mic over. There's enough room for everybody. So Stacy is his granddaughter, who can add a little bit to that. Do you want to add to that?
Yes. So when he was about
and unfortunately here, let's why don't you guys all swing just a little bit down this way, and our listeners will give you plenty of time because this story is so riveting, and there's a lot of folks in the studio, but we want to make sure you hear the story. So go ahead.
So when my grandfather was about 14 years old, he was told that he could no longer go to school, and his family had to leave their home and move into the ghetto into a one room with 15 other people. And while he was living in the ghetto, he was taken from the streets, and he was put into a locked basement. And from there, he was sent to several labor and concentration camps. Ultimately, the last camp he was in was Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, he has some interesting stories because the reason he believes he survived Auschwitz is when he arrived in Auschwitz, Mengele, who was the Nazi doctor who would decide whether you went to the gas or whether you went to work, pointed to my grandfather to go to the gas. And my grandfather's father owned a hat company, and the man right beneath him at the hat company happened to be a capo in Auschwitz, which was one of the Jewish prisoners who had a higher position in the camp. And he saw my grandfather in the line for the gas and pulled him out and put him in the line for work. And in addition to that, he made sure that my grandfather was assigned an extra job. During the days, my grandfather would have to go and dig holes and do whatever jobs the Nazis were requiring them to do. But after that, he would then have to clean his... He had this extra job where he would have to clean a Nazi officer's apartment or room. And he believes that that's the job that helped him survive, because while he cleaned this Nazi officer's room, he would eat the scraps of food that were in there. So ultimately, Nazi officers knew that the Russians were approaching the camp, and so they decided to send them all on a death march. So he was sent out, I believe it was around January 17th, and they marched from Auschwitz, ultimately ending around May 5th in Germany, where he was liberated on the side of the road, first by the Russian.
By the Russian.
And then
the American came in.
And after that, he went back to his hometown to see if his parents or his siblings had survived. Unfortunately, they had not. But his father was one of eight, and the other seven siblings and their children lived in a nearby town where he would spend his summer. So he went to that town, where he found two first cousins and a woman who ended up later being his wife.
So, Elliot, I want to ask you, what questions stood out to you most? What did you most wonder about with your great-grandfather's story?
Well, as I said before, everyone really focuses on what happened during and after, but I like to focus on what happened before. And so a lot of the questions that stand out are like, how were you treated before the war? Because as it says in the movie, there was always a little bit of trouble for Jews, and it wasn't always perfect for them. There's always discrimination, but it wasn't as bad as the Nazis. It wasn't like they're not allowed into hotels or restaurants, and they still had their own shops, and everyone would go to them. But there were still some problems, and Jews weren't always treated fairly. And so that's why it was easier for the Nazis to point them out as the scapegoats or the people who did everything wrong and made Poland and Germany horrible.
Jack, when you think about the fact that you could have been in line for the gas, as
yes,
they say.
Yeah.
Were you thinking in those days, this is it for me?
Didn't care. I know sooner or later I wind up in the gas camp. You know, I was used already.
Were you scared? Yeah? Were you? Did you have fear?
No fear.
I think it's because he was put in the position that he was going to die so many times throughout so many different camps that a lot of them had no fear and they just wanted to get all the pain and suffering over. But obviously they were relieved when they were freed because they realized they would never have to.
There are moments in the film where they're going through photographs and Elliot has questions on who's this person? Who's this person? How valuable to you are those images, Elliot?
Well, most of them are from after the war, but they're still really important since they were like, a lot of them were just after the war, when my grandfather was born, when they had gone to the displaced persons camp. But one of them that was really important, where he points out his dad, that photo is the only remaining photo from before the war and the only photo we have of any of his parents or siblings or anything. It's because there's some of his aunts, uncles, his dad, and another guy. And that other guy had held on to the photo throughout the war and was able to return it to my great-grandfather and my family after the war.
So many remarkable little moments here. We're talking to Elliot and Jack. Elliot's 12. Jack is 92. That's his great-grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, of which we know there are, Bonnie, do we know, I mean, fewer than 100,000 survivors now left in the world. Do we
yes.
know roughly?
Yeah, and I mean, the Rochester area, we still have about 30, but they're aging rapidly. And we only have about 7 or 8 who are still able to speak and tell their stories.
Yeah, hearing these stories, and we've had a chance just in recent days now to hear several, remain so powerful when it comes directly from the survivors themselves. And I'm really moved at the detail that Stacy and Elliot already have to share with what Jack went through. And that will be vital going forward when families only have these stories left. But I find it so valuable to hear these stories directly from the survivors.
That's one of the reasons we set up the Rochester Survivor Archive, because you can hear any of the survivors that have made tapes. You can hear them tell their story. And for those that we didn't have tapes of, you can see pictures and summaries of their stories, because we figured that we really needed to make sure that these voices continue to be heard. And
Jack, can you tell me about what you remember about the liberation, your liberation?
After liberation?
No, when it happened. You said
after
it was on the
liberation.
On the road.
Oh, on the road. Yeah, we was liberated. And we were walking. Long time. How long we walk? 17. From
January to May.
May 5th or the 6th, we was liberated by the Russian. When the Russian left, the American came in. But the Russian was good.
Did it...
We asked for food. We was hungry. They didn't have no food. They only had vodka. That's a true story.
I don't mean to laugh. Everyone laughed, so I find it okay that I let that out. That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Did you drink the vodka?
Vodka? No, I wanted food. But they didn't have any. No food.
Did the Americans have any food?
Yeah, American brought some food.
Do you remember what you were thinking during those hours and that day, you know, that this is it? It's over?
It's over. We were so happy. I go see my family. I was looking forward. But nothing happened.
Jack, I also want to ask you, is it amazing to you that there are still so many people in this world who doubt or deny what happened to you?
Yeah, that's what I hear a lot of things. When I was in the table where I sit around, I ask questions to people. Did you know what we were when I went through? Well, I hear a little bit, but written, then I have to tell them the story. See, they open up their eyes, their mouth. What?
Are you worried that anything like that could ever happen again?
I don't think so.
You don't think that will ever happen again?
Never happen again.
That the world has learned its lessons.
All right. They did.
Bonnie, do you agree?
Not really, because we continue to have genocides. I think the Holocaust still remains a unique genocide. As a matter of fact, the word genocide was coined after the Holocaust, because there wasn't a word to describe this, and there have continued to be genocides, but the Holocaust was still a very seminal event. It was mechanized death. It wasn't, you know, people just killing people because I want your land or I want your resources. It was just, we want to wipe these people off the face of the earth, and it was done in an industrial way. So that remains a unique genocide, but certainly genocide unfortunately continues.
Is it because of any sort of current world conditions, or do you think that man is sort of preconditioned to war? Are you sort of a pessimist in that way?
Well, I used to like things. I'm also the child of two Holocaust survivors, and so I've, like Elliot, you know, the Holocaust is something I've known about since I was 4 or 5 years old, and I used to think, it was kind of naive, that if we had television at the time, then people would see these images, then they would stop it, but then we've had television. We have, you know, instantaneous communication now. And I just think part of it is because there aren't enough people who have the courage to stand up and stop it. I think that's what, I mean, that sounds naive also, because it's scary. People say, be an upstander. It's not that easy to be an upstander by yourself. You need whole societies to be upstanders.
And now think about what Jack went through, even after liberation. I mean, the story doesn't stop on the side of the road there. Jack, my understanding is you go home, but you had lost family in the Holocaust.
The whole family. The whole family.
Everyone was gone.
Everybody's gone.
He only found two cousins, and that was it.
I mean, I can't even imagine how you start rebuilding a life where everyone is gone.
No.
What brought you here?
What do you mean?
Why did you decide to come to Rochester?
So one of his friends...
Go ahead,
one of his friends lived here, and so they convinced him to come, and that's also how he got into the fish business, because they owned a fish store. And so they kind of they sponsored him and got him into America.
So, Jack, I want to ask you if a story is true. It's the story that you ran Jack's Fish Market on Joseph Avenue for decades.
Yeah.
And when people would come into your store when they were hungry, you knew what hunger was because of what you... And so you would feed them for free.
Right.
Yes?
They never went out hungry. They always get food, drinking. Sometimes they asked me for money. Money I didn't give because I was afraid they might use it for drugs.
Or vodka.
Yeah, something like that.
But food, yes.
Oh, yeah, food all the time. Yeah.
Tell me about the French fries.
Fish and fries.
If they were so if you're going to tell the story, Stacey, grab that microphone. Go ahead. Tell us the story.
He told all the children who were hungry, if they went to school during the day, they could come into his store afterwards, and he would give them fish and French fries.
Right. Fish. After school, they was waiting.
There was a line?
A line waiting for fries and fish.
I love that story.
Yeah, it was very nice.
And that's empathy right there, man. Jack is providing a service in this community because he knew what hunger was like during the Holocaust, trying to survive, walking on the road. And that's just an amazing part of the fabric of this community. Our listeners might remember in a few years back, we commemorated the 1964. They're known as the riots in Rochester, and a lot of shops were broken and burned. Not yours.
Not mine.
His was
all my helpers. I got all those helpers. They stayed in front by the window.
They linked arms in front of your shop.
And they didn't, nobody broke in, nobody broke the window. I was the only one.
Elliot, what do you know about that story?
I know that he was, so there were a lot of riots on his street, and all his African-American workers, they stood chained in arms, and they were saying how good of a man he was, how he would get everyone free food, he would give them free drinks, he wouldn't make them pay if they couldn't. And so he was a very helpful man, and he helped everyone out. And so he was the only store untouched on the street.
What did that mean to you, Jack?
What do you mean?
Was that an emotional thing for you that your store was protected?
Yeah, well, I was, how you call it? Emotion.
You were emotional about it.
Yeah. It's like everyone says, if you're nice, it's going to pay off in the future. And it really did for him. His store was untouched. All his property was saved, and so, yeah.
It's like, poor Elliot doesn't know that the world doesn't have factories for philosophers. You should be in philosophy. I mean, like, do all the things you've learned from your great-grandpa. Just amazing stuff here. And I did want to ask you, Elliot, you know, you're 12, so what grade are you in now?
I'm in 6th grade, and, well, I just finished it, so
you're going to
now
7th.
I'm in 7th.
Going to 7th grade. How much do your classmates know about the Holocaust?
Well, some of them more than others, depending on if maybe they've had a great grandparent or something.
Sure.
Because some kids in my class have great grandparents who were in the Holocaust or who were around in the time and maybe got away or were hiding to try and escape persecution. And so they obviously know a lot more about it than other classmates. And the Jewish classmates also know a lot about it. But then there's some classmates who don't know too much. And I kind of have to try and educate them and get them to learn too. Because it takes everyone to stop it.
I think that's very, very well said. And I assume that your classes cover the history somewhat?
They really haven't, and they give you like a brief summary, I think, in seventh grade, but they really go into it in eighth grade.
Bonnie, how's that sit with you?
Yeah, it's New York State is a mandated state where you have to teach about the Holocaust, and it's generally in eighth grade that. But there are no particular rules about how to teach about it.
I mean, so is it enough?
Is it enough?
No,
I would say some teachers are amazing. Some teachers that use our resources at the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information, and really put a lot of time into teaching. And there are some teachers who, if they'll teach about World War II, and they say, "Oh, and the Holocaust happened, and a bunch of people died," and then they go on to the next thing. So it really depends on the teacher. It would be good if we had more rules about how to mandate Holocaust education in the state.
Well, I mean, you've got kids like Elliot I'm sorry, Stacey, you want to jump in there? Yeah, grab that mic. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say this is exactly why Sheila Nevins at HBO decided to make this movie, because she happened to be at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City, and she saw a book on the shelf that was called The Number on My Great-Grandpa's Arm. And she realized at that point that we're really missing any tools to educate young. She knows that in the United States we start to educate children around eighth grade, but she thought that it was really important to try to start to educate children at a younger age, and so she wanted to make this film, her and HBO, to educate children at a younger age. And so their goal was to, you know, use this film starting with fourth graders and up.
How were they in touch with you? How did that happen?
I happen to be in the right place at the right time. I'm the co-chair of the Associates Board for the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust, and we happened to be at an event where Diane von Furstenberg was the honoree and Andy Cohen from Bravo was the MC. And Sheila had just basically taken this book off the wall in the library, and she said to Andy Cohen, "I need to find someone here who has a child and a great-grandfather that's still alive, and maybe, you know, I can make a movie with them." And Andy Cohen and Sheila came over to me and asked me if I knew anyone who happened to, have a survivor in their family. And I said yes. I had actually just, at the time, this was 4 years ago, gotten home from Poland. My father and I had gone to visit my grandfather's hometown and the camps he was in. And so she said to me, "Do you have any footage of your grandfather?" And I had this, not knowing who she was, I had my own home footage of his story. And so I sent it to her, and she said, "We want to film him." And so they came to meet Elliot and my grandfather, and that's where it started from.
What did you think of that? And listeners, if you're just joining us, Stacey Science is the mother of 12-year-old Elliot, who essentially, star is a weird word for a documentary, but it's Elliot and Jack, his great-grandfather, who survived the Holocaust. Stacey, what did you think of the film? It's only 19 minutes, but it packs so much in, I think, in a really poignant way. What did you think?
I mean, for me, I feel like it's a treasure not only for our family, but for the world, because it is, they did it in such a gentle way, because it's a conversation between a 10-year-old and, at the time, his 90-year-old grandfather. And so it's very gentle, and they use this technique called rotoscoping, where there's animation, but it's not, you know, pretend. Rotoscoping is actually taking historical footage and tracing over it. And so instead of seeing the harsh images that we might have seen when we were younger, it softens it. And so.
Yeah. What Stacey's talking about, just I would have used the term illustrations, but sometimes it's difficult for filmmakers to figure out how to fill holes in narration or storytelling. This is about as well done as I think I have seen with that. I really mean that. I mean, I thought that was so well done, so effective. Andrea Miller, people can see the film when?
Sunday, July 8th at the Dryden Theater at 1 o'clock. And tickets are available on the website, which is rjff.org.
Now, it's only 19 minutes. It's part of the short series, right?
It is,
so
yes.
They would come to see that and do what? Are there others? No, now you're kind of going to the list here. Go ahead.
Now I put my glasses on.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry. Opening day starts at 1 o'clock. The shorts program is at 3:30.
Okay.
At the Dryden Theater. There'll be three shorts that day. Each of them have some Holocaust content. So one of them is the number on Great Grandpa's arm. Another one is called 116 Cameras, which is using new technology to capture survivors' stories. And it's that's a beautiful film. And then the third one also has a local connection. It's called Through the Eye of the Needle. So there's an exhibit that's coming to the Memorial Art Gallery at the end of the summer called Fabric of Survival. And it's a story of a survivor who actually sewed her story. So she uses textiles that will be on display at the Memorial Art Gallery to tell her story of survival. So it's really three remarkable stories, and one being Jack's story, who's here, and the whole family will be at the Dryden with us after the shorts program for Q&A.
I asked Bonnie, I'll ask you, are you worried that anything like this could happen again?
Well, you know, we always say never again, and I think it's our responsibility to make sure that it never happens again and that things like it don't happen again. But we look around the world and we know that to some degree it is. And so it's on all of us to be diligent and aware and do our part.
Yeah, it's like Elliot said, it really is up to all of us, and we have no shortage of war, of strife over religious differences, ethnic differences, racial differences. Unfortunately, so many years after the Holocaust, we've got plenty of it. We're talking about the film and the film festival that's coming up here. So we're going to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, I want to ask Elliot about that number on your great-grandpa's arm and how he describes it and what happens to someone when they become a number and not a name anymore. And so Elliot, at the age of 10 in the film, had such poignant things to say. So we'll pick up there. Elliot, Jack, Stacy, all from this family, and Jack is a Holocaust survivor. Bonnie Abrams, director of the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information at the Rochester Community Federation, and Andrea Miller, who is the director of the Rochester Jewish Film Festival, which is online, and we'll make sure you've got the full list as we get ready to end the hour coming up. So let's get that only break. And we'll come back in a moment. I'll tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Connections. In our first hour, kind of turning convention on its head. There's been a lot of conversations about firearms law, and there's sort of the stereotype that if you're on the political right, you're more likely to own firearms. If you're on the left, you're not. You're going to meet some people who are progressives who own firearms, who have some things that they would want to offer fellow progressives who are not firearms owners as we debate gun policy. Second hour tomorrow, you might have heard of thinkers and drinkers. What is it, and how do you get involved? We'll tell you tomorrow. Welcome back to Connections, and let me correct myself on Bonnie Abrams' title. She's the director for the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information at the Jewish Federation. So I think I blended two organizations for you.
That's,
or promoted you, hired you somewhere else.
But that's, two jobs at once. Wow.
You got nothing to do. Still just the Jewish Federation. I want to turn to Elliot Sainz, who's 12 years old. And, you know, the name of this film is the number on my grandpa's arm, A17606. You started to notice that, you said, you know, maybe 5 years old or so. But I think you had some things to say in the film that I'd like to ask you now about how you think about putting numbers on human beings. Tell me about that.
I think, well, first off, the reason they tattooed it to them is because in Jewish law, kind of, if you have a tattoo or kind of change your skin and way into a different form than how God made it, then you can't be buried in a Jewish graveyard. And so first they tried to take away their religion, tried to make them force them into breaking their own religion. And then they could have put any random tattoo on, but the reason they numbered them is because if you're thought of as a number instead of a name, it's kind of like stripping away their humanity and turning them into robots, almost.
Jack, do you agree with that? How did you feel about having a number?
Number? How I feel? I'm feeling right.
Yeah, and Elliot, do you remember having conversations with your grandfather when you first understood it and how he described it to you?
Well, I don't remember them from
You were only
then.
5, 6, yeah.
Yeah, but my mom has recordings of almost everything we've ever asked him. So I look back, I can watch them and see how he responded.
This is just another reminder of every family, I think. Anybody listening right now, think of your great-grandparents. Think of your great-great-grandparents, your great-great-greats. If you even know whom they were, what would you give for audio recordings of their voice and their stories? I mean, what would you give right now? Well, Jack's stories are going to be in this family forever. And I think it's a reminder for all of us, whether we have a Holocaust survivor in the family or not, the value of preserving stories, connecting this way. We've got the technology to do it now. I'm trying to do it with my family. And Elliot, I know it's going to mean a lot to your family and your descendants. You know, we all want to be here forever, but my goodness, I imagine it's going to be really even more valuable as you get older. What do you think?
Yeah, I feel like it's the reason it's becoming even more important now is because as they're passing away of old age, they can't firsthand account in person.
Yeah.
But it's still very important to have their firsthand accounts. So as the years go on and there's less and less survivors to tell their story in person, it's going to be very important to have the audio and video accounts of them saying it firsthand.
And Bonnie, we've collected quite a bit of that locally now, right?
Yes. We have about 300. We have people who lived here even for a short period of time or people who moved here later. And we're still actually adding to the archive as we get more pictures. Like Stacy found more pictures that we need to add to the archive. But it's kind of a, will always be, not always, but will be a work in progress as we get more and more stories. Some survivors came forth after we did this archive. It was so powerful because they saw it and they said, you know, I never spoke about my story, but now that I see what you've done, I want to give you my story.
I want to ask Jack, but really everyone on this panel, you know, Jack, the ultimate act of anti-Semitism was the Holocaust, but the anti-Semitism is not gone from the world. Did you experience more hatred, anti-Semitism here over the years?
Over here?
Yeah.
Nah, I don't.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that. And what would you, Stacy, what would you have expected Jack to say? Did you, I mean, to some degree, I wonder, Stacy, if you're, when your grandfather's gone through the Holocaust and survived it, just about anything might seem small in comparison. And I wonder if you would have expected him to answer that way.
No, I would. He had told me, you know, he always would tell me, say, we're eating out and a fly lands on my food and, you know, I don't want to eat. And he'd laugh at me, oh, flies, you know, you should see what we had to eat. Or, you know, if we're outside and it starts to rain and I ask him, Poppy, do you want your jacket? Oh, we walked from January to May with no shoes, with no jackets. I don't need a jacket right now. Like he, you know, I think going through that, he became a very strong, you have to be a strong person, and, you know, he is very strong. And so I think anything that has happened to him afterwards is perspective, right?
We didn't live it, right, Stacy? So we can't necessarily feel it exactly, but I do think there's great value there. And, you know, Elliot, has he ever given you one of those sort of lectures too? You know, suck it up a little bit there, you know?
A lot of times when I'm around him, I try to, because I think about what he's gone through, and it's like, it feels like whatever I'm thinking about, whatever I'm upset about, is nothing.
Yeah, man, don't you dare complain.
Yeah.
When you're hanging out with a Holocaust survivor, your great-grandpa, I don't think he's got a whole lot of patience for you complaining that a test was hard or whatever it is. That perspective is an amazing thing. Stacy, what about you? Do you see... do you see anti-Semitism in the world today that distresses you, Stacy?
Yes. I mean, it's definitely distressing, which is why I think it's so important to continue to share these stories and continue to educate the world about what can happen if, you know, we don't continue to share these stories. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important that this film was created, because we can start to educate the next generations. It's a tool. It's 18 minutes. It's very easy for teachers to use in schools and for people to see all over. And it's very digestible by younger children. So, you know, I think it's really important that we continue to share all these stories to prevent from happening again.
Yeah.
And also, some people are just saying, oh, it's moved on from Jews, and it's now it's just, like, different cultures and races. But I was recently in Poland, and when we were in the... when we were looking around, there were a bunch of museums. But one of the museums was the pharmacy. And in it, there were a lot of pictures on the wall. And one of them, it was a graffiti, and it was saying, like, anti-Jewish. And then it had, an X through a Jewish star. And then... I read down on what it was, and it was a graffitiing from 2013. So even though it was so long ago, it's still going on in minor ways, and you really got to stop it.
Yeah. Let me grab a phone call on the subject of putting numbers on people. This is Richard calling from Lock near Auburn. Go ahead, Richard.
Hey, hi, Evan. Hello to your guest. I thought it was an amazing coincidence, or maybe not a coincidence, but at least interesting to me that Jack's number begins with the letter A, and that in all this conversation about the immigrants being taken at the border in Mexico, you know that all of their numbers begin with the letter A. If you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I was not aware of that, Richard. I can feel that you see a troubling parallel.
Well, it may be just a coincidence, but it just seems kind of troubling that that's the same number. Now, when the Nazis tattooed people, did they use all the letters of the alphabet? Did they use certain letters to signify different things?
Thank you, Richard. I don't know, but Stacy, can you address that?
There were, I don't remember how many letters, there were more letters used because there were so many people, you know, that they, some of them were, they classified them by certain places and certain, you know, coming from certain areas and what type of prisoner that they were. So there were more letters.
Yeah, and Bonnie, you know, Richard is seeing disturbing parallels, and I understand the modern concern. I mean, the Holocaust and Nazis at the time of Hitler were, I mean, it's you know, sort of a pinnacle atrocity of humankind. So I understand the modern concern about trying to identify, are we on a path that way? Is this part of what leads to this? Or fascism looks like X, Y, and Z. Do we overdo it? Or is it important to learn from that in a way that puts us on guard?
I think it is important to always be on guard. But I'll tell you, as a member of the Association of Holocaust Organizations, there's a listserv. And so directors of Holocaust centers and Holocaust academics who teach the Holocaust, there's been a lot of back and forth over the last couple of years as there's been a rise in hate crimes. And the back and forth has been some of the center directors are like what concerned like Richard that everything is a sign, and others are like, stop, you know, minimizing what the Holocaust was by comparing everything to the Holocaust. So, but I think that what we can all agree on is that to be mindful. So even if some people are insulted by the parallels, or some people think there needs to be, it just makes you aware and makes you think about what's happening and perhaps more interested in taking a stand.
Yeah, Richard saw a parallel on the southern border, putting numbers on families crossing the border. As we talk about the Holocaust, obviously they put numbers on people like Jack. One of the things that Hitler did to drum up anti-Semitic sentiment was to describe the crimes of the Jews, the so-called crimes, and all of the things that should make us fearful or concerned or disgusted by Jewish people. And President Trump at a rally last week was talking, he brought out families of people who had been hurt by people who were undocumented immigrants. So some saw parallels there. Others say it's still inappropriate to draw the parallel. So I understand it as an intellectual exercise just to be careful. And do you, how much anti-Semitism do you sort of feel and see with any routine, Bonnie?
Yeah, in my personal life, I've been fortunate. But, you know, when you think of Charlottesville, you think of all of the things that have happened over the last few years. And there's also in Europe, there's a rise in anti-Semitism as well. I think when countries become very to the right and nationalistic, that there's a tendency to demonize the other because you're not one of us. And to me, that's kind of a scary trend that I see in the world. I'm not sure where it's going to go or if it will stop, but that's a trend that I am seeing.
There's a real fear of multiculturalism in some circles, and there's also an embrace and a celebration of multiculturalism in many more places, which I'm happy to come down on the side of the embrace. To those who fear it, I just don't know what world you think is going to be pure enough for you. When do we draw the borders and separate ourselves enough that you feel it is pure and safe? I don't think that we could possibly draw that in any sort of realistic way, and I think we need to erode fear. And part of the work of the film festival is to not only tell stories, to learn historical lessons, to erode that fear, to understand what has happened. And so let me ask Andrea Miller to tell us a little bit more about what else is coming up. You've got, 29 films, I think, overall? Is that right?
We have 29 films over 8 days. Nine of the films have some sort of Holocaust content to them. Because, you know, you asked the question about current events, and one of the things that is always reflecting current events is the arts. And so if you look among bookstores right now, and I think films are to come because they take a little bit longer to make, you see a lot of this. So there's a bestseller right now called Semitism. So many of the films this year have to do with something to do with the Holocaust because the stories are still coming. And every year we are surprised. There's a group of 18 people who screen the films all year long. And we are always surprised at the number of films that have Holocaust content. And that's because there are millions and millions of stories. And each one of those people who suffered during the Holocaust has their own, who knows how many stories people like Jack have. So this year we have some films that are post-Holocaust, so some stories about what's happening to people after. As I already explained, the three shorts. We have a beautiful film on Monday night, July 9th, called The Essential Link. Bonnie is actually going to be moderating the conversation, but it's the story of Wilfred Israel, a name that a lot of people don't know, but he was one of the architects behind the Kinder Transport, which was, many people know about it, saved many, many, many Jewish children. And he was a businessman in Berlin, owned a sort of Bloomingdale's of the times, and now his story is out. So there are so many stories. Bonnie, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit more about Wilfred Israel.
Yeah, that to me, the talk about new stories, about 4 years ago, again, somebody contacted me about support for this film, and I had never heard of Wilfred Israel, so I sent something out to the entire listserv, and the only person who heard anything about him was, I think he died in a plane crash with Leslie Howard, and that's the only thing that was known about him. And because I didn't want to put forth support for something without checking if it was historically accurate. And 2 short years later, I was so pleased that, this film was actually made and now people know the story. And he was just a silent voice behind this. I met a woman who will hopefully, she will be joining us, who was a Kinder Transport survivor. And she was the first person who told me about Wilfred Israel. And so she'll be on the panel along with the director of the film.
Full list of events and films where, Andrea?
On the website, rjff.org. It is not a festival just with films that have Holocaust content, however.
Of course.
Opening night, a film about Sammy Davis Jr. Saturday night, the brand new documentary, Fresh from Tribeca, film festival, Love, Gilda, about Gilda Radner.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful film about Itzhak Perlman on Thursday night. So there is a lot of fun and a lot of laughter among some of the more substantive.
Love, Gilda is going to sell out. I mean, a lot of this. I mean, I understand it's tough, but I mean, I think it's a good point because we focused on Jack's story, understandably so, but there's a wide range.
Yes.
So rjff.org.
Yes.
Full list, tickets, et cetera. Evelina is an Eastern European who writes to us and says, this has been an important conversation. Genocide and more broadly cruelty begins with dehumanizing people, assigning numbers to them, relegating them to a group of not like me, literally numbering them. And I think about Jack's story, and thank you for that, Evelina. It's just a reminder to us that when we dehumanize, there's a real risk of the paths we take. And I wish everyone could see the way Elliot and Jack, they hold hands, they have their arms around each other. None of it looks contrived. I mean, it's not contrived. There's real love and beauty in this family. Elliot, I hope you're happy with the film, and I know a lot of people are going to be moved by it. I want to thank you for being here and telling your story, your family's story, and the film is outstanding. Thank you so much. The film is the number on Great Grandpa's arm. Jack, continued good health, and thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Stacy Science as well. To you, continue good health to your family, and thank you for being here to share the story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Bonnie, as always, nice to see you. Thank you for the work and for being here.
Thank you so much.
And our thanks to Andrea Miller as well. Good luck with the festival. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to Rob. I know, I just looked at Rob Braden, the engineer, and we kind of just both exhaled. It's just one of those hours where there's just it's a lot to take in. Rob's the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow. A member-supported public radio.